Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name's Stuart Miles and welcome to the Apocalypse Podcast. Augmented reality has been around for several years, desperately trying to break into the mainstream with products that consumers will be keen to use daily. And with a bevy announcements from Unreal and Qualcomm, and rumours Apple might finally be getting ready to get into the market, what's the state of the industry, and does the technology have what it takes to become a viable category in its own right? Apocalypse editor Chris Hall joins me to discuss more. Meanwhile, I've been talking to the head of performance at Guild Esports about how he goes about getting the most from some of the biggest esports stars in the game and how you can adopt some of those techniques he uses to improve your own gaming prowess. And finally, Chris returns to tell us how he's been getting on with the latest Sony active noise cancelling headphones. The Sony WH-1000XM5 are the latest offering the company's long line of successful headphones range, but with a new design and a highly competitive market, do they have what it takes to still be a worthy contender for you to buy? Stay tuned to find out. But first, let's talk about AR, Chris. What's been happening?
Well, there's been a few developments in the past few months. The biggest, probably for real people, is that a company called Unreal has decided that it's going to partner up with EA in the UK to launch the Unreal Air. This is a pair of augmented reality, mixed reality glasses that you can wear and you can still see the real world, but there are two displays inside, so it can form a virtual world that you can look around at the same time. The thing to note about this type of viewer is that it's got a cable, so you need to plug it into your phone, and then it needs a nice healthy connection to provide all of your data, which is why EE is interested in it and thinks that it's going to be, you know, something that a lot of people are interested in. The reason why that's interesting, and I mentioned that being a cabled version, is because just as that's coming onto the market in the UK, Qualcomm have shown off a development version of the next gen for these type of glasses. And that's one that does it all wirelessly, which will remove that tether, meaning that you can just wirelessly connect to your phone, which should be in your pocket or your bag. And then you don't have to think about where this cable's going as you move your head around exploring this virtual world. So it's quite an interesting time. Real products come into market. There's definitely a growing amount of interest out there. And there is a realistic vision of what the next version may look like, which could be much more appealing.
And do you think having used, you've certainly used the Unreal, haven't you? And HTC Flow, is that right?
HTC Vive Flow, yes. I've also used that version, which is, again, tethered, slightly different, but yeah, similar sort of concept.
And from your concept, so from your use of it so far, do you, is it there? Are we ready yet? Is this still a hot air? It feels like this kind of AR has been bubbling around for a long time and it's yet to break through to really become like a sort of thing that, you know, like a smartphone or a smartwatch or even AirPods or, you know, whatever that you that everybody needs to go out and buy. Are we there yet?
At the moment, I'm not sure that we are. We're still in that kind of space, like a sort of sealed virtual reality headset. You know, that's been adopted by some gamers. So if you think about the big tethered units that came from HTC Vive and then the evolution to make it slightly more wireless, like MetaQuest headsets and things like that. And that can give you a closed off environment where you're playing around a virtual world. And that's a great experience. On the other side of it, you have the augmentation of what can be seen in front of you. You know, layering information on what you're looking at to give you more guidance, you know, and that's always been showcased for, you know, mechanics working on an engine or something like that. The problem seems to be finding a fusion of these two different versions of what's almost the same thing and pulling it together into a form factor that normal people will be happy to wear. And so we've mentioned the Unreal ones, and although you can see through them, and they are a little bit lighter, there's still quite heft to them. I mean, you can put it in its case, you can walk around with it in your bag. So we're getting to the point where I could go and sit on the train and put on a headset and immerse myself in this different world while still being able to see what's going on around me. The idea being that you can then take the experience of your phone and put it onto a larger display. So I don't have to look at a 6-inch display. I can look at a 210-inch display instead. You know, it's enormous. But there's still this sort of issue of, do you really want to go there? Are you going to have the control that you want? And there are a lot of moving parts here. Because on one end of the scale, you have just the display stuff. And the display stuff is great. I think we've reached that point where they have the quality and the refresh rate. And there are various form factors emerging where you can put these glasses on and look at something and think, oh, yeah, that looks great. So that side of it is sorted. But at the moment, for the portable glasses type ones, most of them are controlled by your phone, using it as a virtual pointer and using a sort of click on display type thing. So if you want to interact with it, you need to, you know, tap, and that might launch a ball or fire a gun. HTC Vive will Vive Flow will let you tap on four different positions around your phone screen to create different actions. And you can already get the sense that there is some complexity there. You can't see your hand because you're stuck in a virtual world and you're tapping around on your phone trying to get the action you want. So one side might be select and the other side might be the trigger. So different things are happening. There is advancements to take this forward with front-facing cameras that will start to go into gesture recognition, something like that. But I think once you get to that point, we're going to see things change wildly. But it does raise this huge question again of whether people will want portable systems like this that rely on hand gestures, given that they're going to be out in public. Because if you're sitting on the bus trying to wave your hands around, then immediately you run the risk of swiping things and hitting people and stuff like that, because you still need a sort of safe play area.
Sure.
And so that raises more questions. Is it about portability to make these things work? Or is it going to be about playing at home in a sort of convenient virtual world without having to have a supercomputer to power things? So there are lots of questions. At the moment, I can't see that there is one device that's going to provide the broad range of experience to cover all these things. It kind of feels like you have to say, I'll go for the Nreal Air, which will give me that big screen experience so I can sit on the train and watch a film on a big screen, you know, rather than doing it on my phone. Or you go to the other end of the spectrum, shut yourself off, stay at home, sit on the sofa and play an immersive game.
And just as a final quick note, we alluded to, you know, rumours that Apple might finally be getting into the space. They've supposedly shown their headset to the board, which could imply that we might see something later in the year. Do you think, kind of a final word on this, do you think that will make a difference to the industry, or do you think it'll just be another player getting in there?
I think it's actually, it could be incredibly important, and it could be I hate to say it, but it could be the defining moment that this category of devices needs, because the one thing we know about Apple is they're very good at creating consumer experiences to encourage people to go out and invest in their system and you know, people to develop for their system. And that's what all of these sorts of things need. They need good experiences that you can't get anywhere else. They need to not just replicate the phone. They need to take it beyond the phone. And that needs a vibrant developer community. And a developer community needs lots of devices on people's faces to make it worth their while. Apple is likely to be the company that can do that, especially if they go down the wireless route, if they provide all that interactivity, if they just say, yes, this will connect up with your iPhone and off you go, then it could be a breakthrough moment, yes.
Still to come, Chris gives us his verdict on the Sony WH-1000 XM5 headphones.
The interesting thing about these, as you said in the introduction, is that they've completely changed the design. And the initial thought would be that design change was made just so that they look different to encourage people to go out and buy them again. But Sony explained that what they were really doing was trying to reduce the amount of wind noise that was created by those headphones when you were wearing them outside.
As you walk around the corner, you're confronted by numerous enemies that have just one thing in their mind, your death. You look at your health, it's low. You look at your ammo count, that's low too. What do you do next? If the answer is to panic and run in the opposite direction, run away, you might find that you need some performance coaching. Which is handy, as that's exactly what Edgar Jaquira's job is. He's the head of performance at Guild Esports, an esports organization co-owned by David Beckham. Based in London and Manchester with its own academy that fosters young talent, the Guild fields professional teams across Fortnite, Rocket League, FIFA, Valorant, and many more. Keen to know more? I started by asking what the job entails.
So, like I said, my job is, it's kind of like a management job in a way where, you know, we have this team of really good professionals, healthcare professionals, where we can distribute them to different players that we have. But I work obviously within esports, so we have a lot of gamers that we have here. So I need to understand the needs of the players, need to understand, you know, what goals they have, and actually just want to be a facilitator of growth for them. So for those who don't know, esports, like, it's professional gaming, essentially. And, you know, we perform at these big competitions there. Recently, we competed in Sweden as well for the eChampions League final. And my role is to make sure that they get the best support that they can to perform on the day.
And so how do you, obviously, esports is, for a lot of people, feels probably like quite a new sort of sport and a new venture. And I know it's been going on for some time, but how would you describe your job is different, and is it different to, you know, preparing someone for a tennis championship, say, for example, compared to an esports championship?
Yeah, so I've worked in both fields. So I've worked in traditional sports, where I've worked with, like, some great British sprinters, worked with some international powerlifters, and funnily enough, the approach isn't as different as people might think. So working with, let's compare maybe some FIFA players to some, like, international powerlifters.
Sure.
Everyone still needs to be in that specific zone. So some people have, like, they need to feel really aroused, really energetic before they compete. And then the strategies you use are going to be the same. It's just maybe the context a little bit different. For example, maybe in FIFA, you want them to visualize, you know, what confidence feels like in playing. And the content of that is going to be different to a powerlifter visualizing confidence in, you know, performing a lift well. Because sometimes feeling confident helps them feel really energetic in a way. So the strategies are somewhat similar. It's just a little bit tweaked. So it's not as different as people would think it might be.
And how did you get into the role? How did you suddenly switch from traditional sports to esports?
So I think I'm the kind of person who likes to have his fingers in many pies. Basically, I like doing a range of things. So I've always cared more about just performance, not just traditional sports, but just people who perform. Like, it could be in gymnastics, could be in dancing, could be musicians. So when I was talking to a friend of mine, because I originally started in traditional sports, so I was a rugby player myself, but working in traditional sports, I was talking to my friend about gaming, because he's really avid in gaming as well. And he said, oh, there's a CSGO team, which is a Counter-Strike team, which is like a first-person shooter game. And they said there's a psychologist that works there. I was like, oh, wait, no way. Like, is there? I didn't know there was a market in it, right? So when he told me this, I kind of dived in a little bit more into esports and found that there was, like, a really good market for it. And people really cared about the mentality of how to progress as a player just as much as they do in traditional sports. So I was emailing around different teams, you know, how, you know, being self-employed, you know, you got to just reach out to everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, some teams got back, and it gave me opportunity to really embed myself within the culture and to really understand, you know, emotional control was something that's needed within players. You're working with actual younger players too, compared to older players. So younger players have, they might not know how to cope with certain situations more. So the room for development and growth is a lot higher. So that's how I kind of started into it. And then just because I love seeing people progress, it was kind of like a high for me. So I just kept on chasing it a little bit more and work with more people. And, you know, I've really enjoyed the journey I've had over the last couple of years in the industry.
And have you found that, is there a stigma to esports? Because, you know, you talk to some people, and obviously, you know, it is becoming a professional sport. But there are some people that think, oh, they're just playing video games.
Yeah.
Do you find that? Is that an issue still, or is that sort of an outdated viewpoint?
Yeah, I think it's still an issue, but I think it's like an older generational issue. Like, you know, the comparison I can have is with music, right? When, you know, you play any form of modern music to anyone who's older, they're like, oh, this isn't real music. You know, back in my day, this is what real music was, you know? So I think it's ever changing, because that's the thing with society. Everything's always changing. There's ebbs and flows to everything. But there's still that stigma that's around, where people be like, oh, I don't know why you're working in games. Like, it can't be that stressful. But I like to tell people that, let's say the Fortnite Cup, World Cup, there was $3 million at stake, right? You're performing in front of big crowds. You have almost a million people watching you, right? Like, it's a very nerve-wracking and stressful experience. And that in itself adds the components of what sports are. There's a lot of research and a lot of papers that actually try to define what a sport is. And the only difference between esports and traditional sports is the physicality of it. But there's still an element of it, but it's not to a higher degree. So, you know, there is that stigma, but it's also changing.
And you talk there about mental support. Yeah. And sort of, you know, it's more of a necessarily mental thing rather than a physical thing. Mm-hmm. How do you go about helping your players? I suppose they presumably they suffer from burnout and just sort of, you know, in the same way that a regular athlete does. So how do you go about helping them?
Yeah, burnout is a really big, I think, problem within esports, just because you can play hours and hours and hours and end, and because your body's not physically exhausted, you mentally can get there. Obviously, the important bit is really introducing self-care strategies. So getting people to understand what is it that they like doing outside of just playing the game. That's normally done as well within traditional sports, like getting people to understand that you're not just a performer. There's also things outside of performance that you do well and that you enjoy. Also, I look into helping the players understand who are you, essentially, like what do you value, what matters to you. So it could be family, it could be friends, it could be doing art, it could be being quite creative. There's a lot that's been done within burnout and research in there. But sometimes if we're looking into motivation as well, it links with that question of, you know, why do you do what you do? Like, nobody's obviously forcing you to do this.
Right.
What is the motivation behind that? And really trying to package everything where they can maintain that amount of effort without overdoing themselves. For example, I tell them, how much sleep do you feel like you need? Or, you know, looking into nutrition as well, because nutrition is going to be important. Like, if you eat badly, then, you know, you're going to easily feel burnt out. Your mental resources are going to be obliterated, you know, if you're just eating rubbish all day. And also introducing strength conditioning practices as well, where there's just walking around, you know, for a little bit, getting the lungs pumping, you know, really improving your social health and social support and really embracing that as well. So a lot of different things that you can do with burnout, but, you know, we take that holistic approach really within esports.
Now, you might say that you've already told me. I was going to ask you, what's your top three tips for anybody that's kind of thinking about, you know, playing games professionally?
Yeah.
What's kind of to help them on their way, to sort of empower them? What would be your tips? And I know, obviously, you've just said, you know, eating well, sleeping well, doing things that are outside of the games. Is there any other sort of things that you think, right, just, you know, as a base standard, this is what you should be doing?
I think anyone going into, obviously, any form of like high pressured environment, they need to learn to be a bit more self-aware. So I really push on the use of reflections. So getting a structured reflective practice in. So it could be three simple questions: what went well today, what didn't go so well, and then making an action plan. I think that last bit is normally the hardest one for people to do, because this is like a skill. So we're kind of used to being told what to do and kind of used to just kind of going through the motions. But reflecting gives you the reins a little bit more, where you think introspectively, like, okay, this is what I need to potentially work on. And specifically, these are the strategies I can use. So example, it could be using of breathing techniques if you notice that you're quite a nervous performer. It could be you need to work on communication skills, so maybe you need to work on slowing down your speech when you're talking to other gamers when you're in lobby. It could be taking 10 seconds if you know that you're a really aggressive player. Like, the key thing with psychology, with mentality, is always be self-aware, so you notice what's going well for you and not going well for you, and then putting those plans of action forward. I guess another one would be, I think it's just social skills, really, like just developing that ability to communicate effectively with other people is going to be really useful. Even if you're in a single player game like FIFA, for example, right? You still need to talk to your coaches, still need to talk to your organization as well. And, you know, if your communication just breaks down, then, you know, things can be misinterpreted, things can go badly, or maybe you're trying to communicate what you need, but you're not doing it effectively. Being able to know what you want to say and actually be able to say it is going to be quite vital for pro players. And I think the last one is just being able to, you know, be a little bit more mindful, you know, be some present in the moment. Like I said originally, no one's forcing you to do this. You're doing this because you enjoy doing this. So really taking the time to be present in the moment, you know, be where your feet are is a saying I like to use quite a lot with players, of, you know, just really embrace that moment that you're in. Like, although it's a pressure situation, it's a bit of a privilege in that way, and just try to enjoy it as much as you can. I think those would be some additional tips there.
Cool. Thank you very much. And do you think, where's the future of esports and your role within that? Do you see this becoming, you know, most teams will have, if they haven't already, will have someone like you coaching them to make sure that they're, you know, mentally sound and everybody's happy and performing to their best? Or, yeah, you know, is that where it's going to go? Do you think that esports will either is already or will have the same standing in sort of support base? Basis as you know, as Man United or Liverpool or, yeah, or, you know, the New York Mets or whatever.
Yeah, I definitely think so. The way it's heading, because like when I first started compared to now, you're seeing a lot more healthcare professionals coming into the scene and providing that support, like a multi-tiered level support to these players. But also you're seeing academies being built up. So I know Guild has an academy as well that's been set up, where we're trying to now develop like grassroots talent to try to get to that elite kind of level in ways. And this copies maybe the models of like a Man U or an Arsenal or, yeah, you know, Liverpool, where you're actually developing young talent and then you're giving them the resources. So when they do come into elite status, they have the ability to cope with having 100,000 followers or, you know, playing for 500K prize pools and stuff like that. So you're seeing it really be, it's being structured in a way where it models traditional sports, but actually invests a lot more into the support background. Because I've seen from my time that a lot more care and a lot more attention is being put into the support stuff now within esports, right, compared to other traditional sports.
With the MH1000XM5, Sony has completely revamped the design of its ever-popular flagship headphone line. But is the redesign for the better, or has the urge to change things taken a step too far? Pocalint's Chris Hall joins me again and has been wearing the new headphones and is here to tell us how he's been getting on and whether you should get a pair yourself. So, Chris, are they good?
Yes. Easy answer. They're very good.
Brilliant.
I'll take you all the way back to 2016 to start the story. I was lucky enough to go to the launch of the 1000X family when Sony said, right, we're going to do something different. I went along to see what it was all about, and I have a pair of those headphones and I have used them ever since. They have been upgraded. We're now in our fifth generation of the 1000X, and they have just got stronger and stronger through every step of their life. The interesting thing about these, as you said in the introduction, is that they've completely changed the design. And the initial thought would be that that design change was made just so that they look different to encourage people to go out and buy them again. Mm. But Sony explained that what they were really doing was trying to reduce the amount of wind noise that was created by those headphones when you were wearing them outside. Because if you can make your headphones quieter on the outside, then there's less intrusion on what you're listening to on the inside. Whether or not that works, I don't know. I mean, I didn't get the opportunity to test them side by side in a wind tunnel or anything like that. But the important thing about these headphones is that they are superb at active noise cancellation. You step out of your house, you put them on your head, you turn on active noise cancellation, and it's like a blanket of silence descending around you.
Wow.
You could walk along, scooters were going past, the Deliveroo drivers were zipping past, and I couldn't hear them. And on one side, that's quite scary because you might step out into the road and get hit by one of these people, which is why there are all sorts of options to allow differing amounts of noise in from the outside. And the whole thing can be automated as well. So you could have complete silence when you're at home or in the office, and then you can have it switch to letting some of the outside ambient sound through when you're walking, and your phone can detect this and tell the headphones how to change. Fantastic set of headphones. The noise, if you're a regular traveler or commuter and you just want something that will keep it quiet so you can hear your music without having to turn the volume up, then it's a fantastic choice.
And is there anything you didn't like?
There isn't much, to be honest. I mean, the sound quality is great. The ANC, as I've said, is great. I found them very comfortable to wear. There was one minor detail, and I don't know if this was just because we have early samples, but I had the silver set. They're called silver, but they're almost beige, I think. But the cables were black. And that caught me by surprise because I opened it up and I thought, I'm never going to use this black cable because it's a different color to these headphones.
Mm.
And that's a, you know, it sounds like a petty thing, but petty things are what matters when you're looking at a £400 set of headphones that you really, really like. And you think that that's a shame. Whether that's going to be the same with the retail sets, I don't know. It's definitely something to look out for. But one of the slight changes is how they fold. Because before there was this sort of, you could flip the cups in to put them into the package, you know, the case, yep, that they came in to make them more compact. Now the cups fold flat instead. So the footprint of the headphones when they're folded up is larger than it was before. That's about it. That's the only minor thing. Unless you want to get into codecs, there's no aptX HD support because they use LDAC, which is a proprietary Sony codec. But LDAC is widely supported by Android, and neither LDAC or aptX is supported by Apple. So it's a moot point. Doesn't matter if you're an iPhone user.
You've obviously said at the beginning that you've been using the original version, and this is obviously considerably better. Do you think if you've been a previous user of these headphones, is it time to upgrade?
That's an interesting question, because the experience of the original headphones is still very good. Sound quality is good. Noise cancellation is good. They're now obviously better. They are better. I would say that if you're still using the original ones, it's probably worth your time upgrading now, because you'll have been using them for a while. The battery life may be starting to decline a little bit, and this will put you back up to 30 hours of active use, which is much longer than it was originally. If you've only just bought a set, if you have the 1000 XM4 that came out last year, it's a hard sell because the experience is very, very close. So if you have some of the earlier generations, yeah, perhaps look at it, see if you can gift them to somebody else, and go and get yourself a new set. If you have a fairly shiny pair of the last generation, then it's probably not worth it.
And the toughest question of all, if when they go back, will you be sad?
I'll be incredibly sad. In fact, I'm already sad. I'm sad just thinking about them going back, because they're just such lovely headphones to use every day.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Until next time, thanks for listening. Pip, pip.